thanks for those very kind words, particularly about the beard. Maybe I'll shave it off tonight and not have it tomorrow. Okay, so, well, we appreciate everybody coming on the last afternoon of a long meeting here to hear about School IPM, because we really want to recruit you and bring you into the fold. Or as Fudd always says, we want to share the School IPM love. Right, Fudd? So, let's get started here. We're going to talk about roles for entomologists of all stripes, and it really comes right out of the PMSP. So, you know, why should we care about IPM in schools? Well, up to 25% of our kids in urban centers like New York City and Boston have asthma, 6% nationally, and that percentage is growing. Cockroaches, rodents, dust mites, and exposure to pesticides can cause asthma and also trigger asthma attacks. Asthma is the number one cause of school absences in the U.S. as well. On top of that, more than 90% of residents in the U.S. surveyed carry a mixture of pesticides in their bodies. Over nine people that were sampled, none of them working in chemical-related industries, had an average of 93 chemical contaminants each in their bodies, and fully a fifth of those were pesticides or pesticide-related compounds. And among those chemicals that we're carrying around are known carcinogens, reproductive and developmental toxins, neurotoxins, and so forth. Very little testing is done on chemicals in combination, so we're carrying around this cocktail with really no sense of what the combinations of chemicals that we're exposed to might be doing to us. Water pollution. We've really been concerned about agricultural contaminants in our surface water, but recently surveys have really shown that urban sources are equally important, and then as we've phased out chlorpyrifos and diazinon uses in urban areas, pyrethroids are now being found at above levels of concern in sediments in the surface water. So this is where some of our pest management practices have gotten us to. Well, what about schools and childcare specifically? Well, we, as part of our strategic plan that we'll talk about more later on in this session and then some other sessions as well, we compiled over 60 references to studies that have been done back since 1993, showing a wide variety of issues that we should be concerned about in schools. Our own program, as Al mentioned, IPM STAR, we go on site with school systems and look at what they're doing. We use an evaluation form and score them on their practices and policies and pesticide selection. And some of the deficiencies we found in our first 29 schools that were published in American Entomologist in 2007 were some really basic things. 38% of schools were not in compliance with either their own policies or regulations that affect them at the state level or federal level. Matching 38% had uncontrolled pest problems. So pest problems in the schools, we bring the administrators around with us when we visit the schools to check for pest and pesticide issues, and almost always by the end of the day the administrators are totally red-faced and embarrassed at what they've seen. Right, Carrie? Didn't we have that experience recently? Because what happens, you know, people complain a few times, nothing gets improved, they're still living with mice running across their classroom every day, they stop complaining because nothing changes and nobody realizes how bad things really are. Other things like insecure pesticide storage, you know, storing danger and warning label pesticides right out on an open shelf in an ag or hort related classroom is something we see all the time, and these are places where kids are supposed to be learning safe pesticide practices. So lots of room for improvement. And we know that IPM really works. Yes, Clay.
Sorry, Tom. Do you want questions as you go or at the end?
Just go ahead. Fire them away.
You sure?
Yeah.
I don't want to take all your time.
No, we're a small, informal group here, and we'll have Mark Lane throw you out the door if we don't like your question.
Mark would be a good hall monitor. The that last slide, so I saw school IPM policies, no written IPM policies, 7%, no written IPM plan, 24%. I would look at, I know there's some other ones that are embarrassing there, but those are pretty favorable. I mean, the fact that they, that only 7% did not have a written IPM policy, that's a good statement. It's a good piece of data. Right?
Well, on the one hand, But we actually, we were picking schools that had a reputation for having an IPM program in place initially. And some of the later schools here were ones that were just getting started. So we were picking schools that were claiming IPM initially because we wanted to go and check and see what they're actually doing. And the glaring thing is that, well, if 93% of these schools had an IPM policy, what difference does that make if, you know, 40% of them are violating the law and 40% of them are not controlling pests adequately? So that's the other side to that coin. Yes?
Were those unregistered updated pesticides in stores, were they forwarded to the state lead pesticide agency? Because that's a direct violation of any state pesticide.
Yeah, in fact, three of those schools had DDT on the shelf. But typically what we do, we're bringing the administrator around with us. We keep our involvement with the school confidential until they're certified. And typically, you know, they're leaving that school visit day with a bag or a box of stuff that they pulled out of the schools.
Can I respond to that too?
Sure.
EPA is really not in the business with school IPM. We see it as a voluntary effort. Right now, there are some states that have regulation, but in general, it's voluntary. And we really see when they use an IPM STAR program and they adopt that program in their school, that is the way to get them to do the right things. We don't really want to punish them, in a sense, for the wrong thing. But they're changing around to do the right thing.
Yeah.
You can't balance punishing them with the liability of the students. I certainly wouldn't want my son or daughter in a school that has DDT on the shelf without some organization, you know, that may have a board-certified entomologist who is required by those bylaws to report that stuff. That should be reported to a state lead agency, whether it's anonymous or whatever. I mean, I think that's unconscionable to not report that to a state lead agency, which has the primary role in enforcing pesticide regulations.
We often have people from state lead agencies coming with us, and they operate in a compliance assistance mode, and that's agreed on beforehand. The worst situation was a pile of pesticides sitting under the bleacher at the high school stadium that had been collected from the schools when the state put a school IPM law in place that said only registered or licensed people can use pesticides. They collected everything from all the schools, piled this in this dump, and many of the labels were gone, and there was just this huge pile of, you know, deteriorated packaging, powder unknowns. It cost the school over $100,000 to get that cleaned up. So it's a situation that you can find when you go out there in schools. We still have 20 of our states where there's no regulation in terms of who can apply pesticide in the school. So anybody can run down, you know, to the farm supply store and buy something and use it for pests in the school without any regulation at all. It's a crime. It is a crime, literally. Okay, so I'll just keep an eye on the time here, but keep firing your questions. I'll speed up if I need to. We know that IPM works. In North Carolina, a study 3 years ago now showed that IPM schools had very little residue versus conventional schools that are sprayed on a regular basis. And one of the big surprises was the amount of residue on the walls in the schools. They're spraying the baseboards, and that drift ends up on the walls. You know, the floors and at least a portion of the baseboards get washed every night. The walls don't, and that's where they found accumulations of pesticides. And we've all seen kids, you know, running down the halls, dragging their hands along the walls. Dawn Googe and her co-authors demonstrated 70% reductions in pesticide use and pest complaints. IPM not only reduces pesticide hazards, but pest complaints as well. Another data out of North Carolina showed that these conventional schools had cockroach allergen levels 200 times that of the IPM schools and 100 times above the levels of concern for asthma. And the IPM schools were below the levels of concern. And we see this time and time again. If you have a conventionally managed school that's getting baseboard sprays, it is not managing the cockroaches. That's where you'll find the cockroach problems. It's the schools where they've got somebody who's familiar with baiting and monitoring that are getting better control of cockroaches with much less pesticide. And the other thing we need to sell schools on is that IPM not only addresses pests and pesticide hazards, but it improves food safety. And as we'll see from some pictures later on about flies moving from dirty drains to food contact surfaces and food. It improves fire safety. You know, if you have a door sweep on the door, it prevents oxygen moving through there to feed a fire. Security, having good maintenance also improves security for the school system. Having door sweeps and good seals on the windows reduces energy costs as well. Does IPM improve attendance? Does it improve student performance? Those are things that we need to find out. Those are opportunities for researchers. So I wanted to back up, not knowing who might be in the audience and what your experience or exposure to school IPM might be, and just do a short introduction to what IPM in schools is all about. Well, it's very common sense. It's not rocket science. We know how to do this. And the first key, of course, is knowing your pests. For example, if you know that mice are pooping and peeing all over the place, if you've got a mouse in your classroom or in your food service area, maybe you'll be more motivated to manage that problem and get rid of those mice. 42 to 60 young per year, so start out with a couple of mice and you end up with quite a few in a short period of time. They also cause a lot of fires by chewing on wiring insulation. The range is 10 to 30 feet typically. So if you see a mouse, their nest is within 10 to 30 feet of where you're seeing them. So you can often very readily find that nest, clear that out, trap the mouse, get rid of the problem. They fit through a quarter inch gap. Very few people doing maintenance in schools have that understanding that mice can squeeze through that small of a gap. So they might put a door sweep on the door, but they leave big gaps on either end or in the middle that are plenty big enough for a mouse to get through. And just that little bit of training can make those maintenance people much more effective tools in your pest management program. As I mentioned, door sweeps can reduce pest complaints by 65%. That's unpublished data out of Florida. And this is how it works. If you think about it, a mouse running along the outside of a wall in a school and ducks in the doorway, if there isn't a seal on that gap there, as far as the mouse is concerned, there's no door there. There's a quarter inch worth of space there, the mouse is right through. Inspection and monitoring are real keys, using glue boards, snap traps, live traps, visual inspections, lots of signs that pests leave behind, using pest report logs for billing occupants efficiently so that when there is a pest issue, people know that they need to report it, and then it gets put through the proper channel so it gets addressed. And everyone can be trained to be alert for pests and pest-friendly conditions. It shouldn't just be the province of the contracted structural pest control provider or the in-house pest management team at the school. We really need to enlist the food service people, the maintenance people, the custodial people, and just do some very basic training for those people as they're hired, and then some continuing education, just as we train them on everything else that addresses IPM and their role to play in the system. When we do need to take action, there are lots of very low toxicity and very effective options to be used in schools. For example, this is a picture that's making the rounds. We're going to see it again later on. The upper picture is a floor drain in a kitchen. This was in a facility that was 10 years old, and that drain may never have been cleaned. It's often a no person's land. The kitchen staff often have responsibility for cleaning in the kitchen. They don't have the tools or the training to get into the drains. The custodial people might have that, or the maintenance people might need to be enlisted in that process if the drain cover is bolted down. But you end up with these festering piles of organic matter that are full of fly maggots, and you get flies of several different types coming out of these drains, landing on food contact surfaces, and carrying all kinds of pathogens with them. So the top picture is an inside drain inside a kitchen, just a big mass of organic matter inside that drain. Amazing that they don't have constant drain clogs with that stuff building up and falling off. On the outside picture in the lower right there is an outside drain in a lower loading dock area. So you've got your compactor out there that leaks liquids and organic matter and accumulates in those drains. Nobody goes in there to clean the drain. You end up with a fly larvae in there as well. And then we've got a whole series of least toxic pest controls. Many pest management professionals no longer use any kind of rodenticide inside buildings. They're using snap traps or glue boards. Vacuums are a great tool for removing cockroaches from their harborages and also removing allergens. And then seal that harborage, that gap that wall-mounted fixture that's in the kitchen, seal that harborage around that, seal the escutcheons closed, rather than having to go back there and apply bait or pesticide to those locations in the future. Keep the cockroaches out. And then just simple cleaning, like cleaning these drains with an enzyme-based cleaner on a regular basis, can prevent that buildup and breeding material for flies. And then if reasonable non-chemical approaches fail, we do have least toxic pesticides, insecticide baits, a little bit of insecticide combined with a food attractant that are very, very much more effective for cockroaches and many ant species as well than spray-applied pesticides. Okay, so the other message about pesticides is that they're not all the same, that we can review our pesticide options and pick those least toxic options among them. So this here is a picture of that loading drain that you saw on the previous slide was full of fly maggots. This was the loading dock area where people in the school were coming out to smoke during breaks and so forth. And because of the fly problem, somebody thought it was a great idea to just hang this no pest strip up there. So they're all, you know, hanging around smoking and breathing in the pesticide as well, which is, of course, doing nothing to manage the flies. Pelleted formulations for rodents, for example, are a real concern in schools. And this is a situation where we had a coach's room behind the refrigerator in the room. They were having mouse problems. Coach got frustrated, just went out and bought some over-the-counter rodenticide. And you can see how the mice, you know, they come along and find, oh, God, look at all this food. We better start spreading it around before the pile disappears. And they'll go in there and take those little pellets and spread them around all over the place. And, of course, they look like candy nerds to kids. So there are least toxic formulations that we can use, a bait block formulation of rodenticide used in a tamper-resistant station, for example, that eliminate this kind of a hazard. But, again, we've always got to be thinking, you know, why are the mice there? Let's trap them out. Let's get the door sweeps on the doors so that when the fall cool weather comes around, we're not putting out that beacon of warm air under that door, just calling every mouse and their cousin to come live in the school. And we also have to remember that IPM is really a continuum of practices. It's not a yes or no. There's always room for improvement. And the question is not, are you doing IPM? Oh, yeah, we've got an IPM policy. But how much IPM are you doing? And our IPM STAR program is based on that idea. And we've got 40-some elements in that evaluation where we're looking at IPM practices and trying to identify areas for improvement, even among the higher-performing schools. So some background on the IPM strategic plan. USDA has commissioned more than 75 pest management strategic plans now, and they're up on the IPM Center's website along with crop profiles. These documents are typically created for a crop and a region. So they're crop and region specific, and they identify the status of pest management for that particular commodity and opportunities for improvement, priorities in the regulatory area, education, extension area. So the school IPM PMSP was an idea of Don Googe. It was commissioned by USDA couple years ago now, and it's just about done. We met as a working group, about 40 professionals from around the country, 2 years ago, and drafted the initial outline and worked on a monthly basis, monthly conference calls, putting that together. And then over the past 6 months, we've just been refining it. It's 284 pages. I think it's in the Guinness Book of World Records for PMSPs out. And the final proof draft just arrived in my email today, so it's going to be handed over to USDA this week yet. In the U.S., we've got 14,000 school districts, 9 million students, about 95,000 school buildings, really a burning need for improvement. The thrust of the PMSP is that we know how to do IPM. We've had demonstrations and research projects. We really do know how to reduce both pest complaints and pesticide hazards. The PMSP is really designed as an action plan to foster more coordination so that we're not out there each doing our own thing, but that we're working together, to also infiltrate and integrate IPM within those organizations of professionals who are working within schools. So the school risk managers, the school food service people, they've all got their professional associations. We need to recruit candidates from in those organizations to be advocates and bring IPM into their organization, so it's part and parcel of school management rather than being a cadre of IPM fanatics trying to pound on them from the outside. And we need more resources, and the grant that Al mentioned, the PREA grant from EPA, is a first step there. We've had the PMSP development funded, and now EPA has provided $250,000 to begin to implement that plan. So you can see the plan. It's up, just Google School IPM PMSP, and you'll see it in its entirety. We'll be updating that with the new version once that's submitted to USDA. And there's an appendix that's a toolbox that includes lots of things that you can use as you're thinking about how you want to get involved in school IPM, which I hope you will do. The PMSP has a section in the strategic plan. This is a page pulled out of it in the lower right that talks about roles for extension in school IPM. And we have similar tables for pest management professionals, for public health professionals, for regulatory officials, and so forth. And we'll just do a quick snapshot of some of those as we go through here. So, number one, we're all parents and or community members and or grandparents who are in a position as entomologists to advocate for healthier schools. You know, we've seen just some of the slides of things that you can find when you go into your kids or grandkids or your neighbor's kid's school. And you know, we've got the ability to recognize those things for what they are and do a little bit of education about how much a little drain cleaning can go towards better pest management. We can also become aware of what the laws are in our state, and it really is a hodgepodge. We've got a table of regulations in the PMSP, so you can see what's happening in your state. You can find out what those legal requirements are and what those written policies, like does your school have an IPM policy? Well, are they doing what it says? And follow up with them to help them walk the talk. Just initiating a conversation on IPM and all of its benefits, not only the pest management benefits, but the related benefits and energy savings and so forth. And then specifically, we need you to go out and identify who in your school system are the decision makers for pest management. You know, who is it that decides who gets the pest management contract? You know, who gets the landscape management contract? Or is it done in-house? Because we want to collect those names and start communicating with them on a regular basis about school IPM. So those 14,000 school districts in the country, we want to have names for every single one of them by the end of next year so that we're going to start sending them the IPM propaganda and get them involved. Maybe your school does have an IPM coordinator. If they do, more than likely, they've had very little training for that position. But the decision maker may be at the superintendent level, maybe at the operations maintenance lead level. Further along the continuum of involvement, you know, you as a parent and community member can become a change agent, one of Mark Lame's favorite expressions. And we have a chapter in the pest management plan that talks about the process of change, the science of bringing about behavior change, and how change agents can make that happen. So you can educate yourself to create awareness in your school system of why they should be doing IPM. Persuade them why it's important. Some of those initial slides, you know, what are the pesticide, what are the pest issues that we're dealing with that people are generally not aware of, and then help them implement and evaluate and confirm. And we've got lots of folks who are just sitting out there waiting for the phone to ring for you to call them up and say, hey, my school system needs some help because we've got some great tools that we can come in and help you get some funding to implement in your school district. There's a listserv operated by University of Florida, School Bugs L. Really encourage you to get onto that list so that you can see the conversation back and forth between school professionals about what's going on. And join the National Working Group, stay in the loop, volunteer, send Kelly your contact information at kadams@ipminstitute.org. Regional Working Groups, we're going to hear more about those later on. There are potential opportunities there for you and for your school district. The IPM Symposium in March 2009 will have a three-session track on school and childcare IPM. If you're doing any work in IPM, it's a great meeting to come to. There are about 20, evenly split, 20-some sessions covering ag IPM and 20-some covering school and other community urban IPM issues. And educating others, we should be having school IPM sessions and posters and presentations at all of our branch meetings over the next few years as we work to bring about school IPM in all of our schools. So what about entomologists in the pest management professions on the commercial side, structural, landscape, public health, consulting, manufacturing, distribution people? How about integrating high-level IPM for schools within your own business? You know, make high-level IPM the way you do business and within your professional organizations. So having school IPM committees in your organization, creating connections between education and safety and environmental and other committees that you may have within your professional society, you know, if you're a structural pest management professional, and making that connection about IPM. Sessions at your meetings, articles in your publication. Really focusing on prevention-based models for these sensitive environments. So we're talking about schools, child cares, health care, elder care environments that we typically talk about as sensitive environments in structural pest management. And then support verifiable performance standards for your professions. We operate Green Shield certified, where we use the IPM STAR model and go on site with pest management professionals to evaluate what they're doing and then give them the Green Shield certified logo to use once they meet the standards. There's another program in California called EcoWise, and then there's a new one that's just been launched by the National Pest Management Association called Quality Pro Green. So lots of choices for people out there to get more formal about their high-level IPM. Regulatory public health entomologists, we've got a whole page of regulatory priorities in the PMSP. And again, you know, lots of opportunities for you as a regulatory or public health entomologist to educate your profession, your colleagues, about school IPM and why it's important and how they can get involved. Extension. Traditional roles for extension really fit well with school IPM. And we've got lots of folks out there with extension responsibilities that really don't have school IPM responsibilities within their bailiwick, but they've taken this on because it's a need in their state and they've convinced their higher-ups that it's worthy of support. And they're doing great things with very little resources, and we can help. And one of the goals of the PMSP was to pull together the tools and the information that you need to sell IPM and implement it. There's no need for each state to have its own school IPM manual. We've got some great manuals out there we can share with you, fact sheets, PowerPoints, grant proposals, and so forth. Researchers. The school IPM PMSP is just a goldmine of opportunities for researchers. We have a page on research priorities that you can cite as, hey, funder, you know, these are stakeholder-identified priorities. This group of 40 professionals from around the country said it was important for us to research this issue. And that's in there. And then Chapter 8 is a pest-by-pest handling of pest issues in schools. And each of those pests also has some priorities identified with it. So where are we at? Well, Al, am I all done? 2 minutes. Okay. So again, PMSP is one of the reasons that they're out there is so regulators like EPA and state regulators can look at stakeholder identified priorities for regulation and here for research as well. So you can really use it to support your grant proposals. So that's it. We want you. Can we circulate a sign-up list?
Sure,
let's do that. And as you'll hear through the rest of the afternoon, it's really fun work. You'll never work with a group that's more receptive to the IPM message than people working in schools. And they've committed their careers to working with kids, and they really appreciate learning how their efforts can improve the environment for kids in their schools. So thanks very much.